This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, WGCU's Mike Kinnairy will sit down with American journalist Susie Hansen, who has lived in Istanbul, Turkey since 2007. She'll be in Southwest Florida on Friday to give a talk at FGCU called The Two Americas: Can Americans See America the Way the Rest of the World Does? But first, we're going to talk about a time when America was divided by civil war and how the country dealt with its recent history in the years immediately following that war and how that version of history is shaping current debate over Confederate war monuments. We're talking about this now because this week a prominent statue of Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general for which Lee County is named, was unscrewed and knocked off its downtown pedestal. It's since been put back in place, but police are still looking for who's responsible. So in the first half of today's show, we're talking with a historian whose area of specialty is Civil War history and the narratives that were intentionally shaped in the years after through textbooks and reframing the cause that the South was fighting for. Dr. Jeffrey Fortney is an assistant professor of history at FGCU, and I was able to speak with him yesterday about Confederate memorials and what they say about our modern framing of Civil War, slavery, and racism. Because this segment is pre-taped, we can't take any calls, but we invite you to share your take on Confederate monuments and how history is perceived. We invite you to do so via social media, on Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Can you take us back to the Civil War and immediately after it? Was it memorialized immediately after?
Yeah, it's a great question. And strangely enough, it was. The battle for Civil War memory is a battle that, strangely enough, is taking place during the Civil War itself. People are fighting over the what are we fighting for? What are we dying for? But it does take a different direction as soon as the South is defeated. You have hordes of ex-Confederates, men and women who are involved in trying to craft the narrative of what this was about. Most tellingly, you see a clear about face. So as the war had started, the Confederacy is very clear about what they are seceding for, what their cause is. This is preservation of slavery. Alexander Hamilton Stevens, Vice President of the Confederacy, makes that abundantly clear. All of the secession declarations are very clear. That is the cause. We are seceding to preserve and spread slavery. That is our new nation. As soon as the war ends, the narrative instantly flips. This war was never about slavery. Instead, it was about what will become what historians have labeled and others as the lost cause mantra. This was defense of home. This was an honorable cause over states' rights. This was the South only losing this based on industry from the North. However, it being a valiant effort all the way through. Of all people, it's Jefferson Davis, Confederate president, who writes this well over 1,000-page book in the aftermath about saying, no, it wasn't slavery. Let's take back all that we said during the war and make it about this. So the battle to shape Civil War memory is immediate. There is no period where it's a let's cool down, let's not talk about this. It jumps out right away.
And those statements are, you can hear them today. People still say that in 2019.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I can tell you countless stories. And I'm told when I tell people that I teach on the Civil War, many times the first response has been, do you teach it right? And I know exactly what they mean when they say that, but if I ask them to elaborate, they say that slavery wasn't the cause, that it was a defense of home, that Lee was an honorable man in all ways, and it was the war of Northern aggression. These statements didn't continue on their own. It took a careful, long-running campaign in order to instill them into our society in so many different countless ways.
And it's still here.
Oh, it's absolutely still here.
So when did we get to the point where we were starting to erect monuments and have statues made of General Robert E. Lee and the Confederate soldier and all this? When did that start cropping up?
It's a great question. It's part of the, I guess, next phase of the movement. So you have initially Lost Cause Mantra, the Lost Cause Creed, as many would call it, that's in the immediate aftermath of the war. Historical societies take up this banner that, okay, we need to get this out there. You have former Confederates who are openly talking about the war for memory, who are openly talking about, I can't let it be remembered. I can't tell my children that what I fought for was this. I can't be on the wrong side. So this is the
wrong side of history.
Wrong side of history, but wrong side of the conflict. So instead it's how did – what was our conflict over? And also where is our victory? For Confederates, it became the victory of Reconstruction, the victory of overthrowing these Republican governments that granted black rights and kicking out the Northern carpetbaggers. Well, in the aftermath of that, this is when you see societies like there are countless different Confederate veteran societies, but they're also, I'd say the most prominent is the United Daughters of the Confederacy that take up the mantra of we need to change the school books. We need to be writing the school books. We need to have power over how people remember and see. And public monuments like Robert E. Lee monuments, which are very popular, are a great way to do that because people walk by and they see General Lee. And you can even put in the placards whatever you want that memory to be. So it's part of – monuments are not themselves popping up in isolation, but as part of a multi-prong attack to shape memory of the conflict and its aftermath.
That's pretty advanced.
It is.
I mean, that's a pretty orchestrated – I mean it's almost like from over here I'm thinking it kind of sounds almost conspiracy theorist that everybody was in on we're going to change the messaging. You know what I'm saying?
It is odd to find so many sources that are so direct about this. And there are certainly ones that are tacit and there are things that I guess sound less Machiavellian than that. So there is also kind of the question of how are they getting away with it? What's the other – part of the country doing that they're allowing this is there's a desire in our country in the aftermath of the war that continues for reconciliation. If you think about Civil War horrors and the tragedies of it and so many dead and that this isn't some distant idea, but you know someone who died, it was upfront, it was personal. As a country, the need to reconcile, the need to be able to move beyond is a real desire. And in a lot of ways, this outweighs any desire for justice, any desire for
– factual correctness.
Yes. At some point, they look and say, well, do the facts matter all that much or can we more shape things to the part of the lost cause narratives where you see it that it's really winning, where you see it's winning over Northerners is the idea that we're all right. We were all right in this conflict. Both sides were. I mean, that they would say it's just like I was right and so were you.
Healing after a civil war, you know, when you really come to think about it, cannot be easy because this is somebody that you were just killing.
Yes.
You know, you were actually killing them, their family, ruining their property, burning down everything. The Reconstruction had to happen because everything just kind of got ruined, right? So then you have to be able to say we're both Americans now again. So there was a need for – I don't know about forgiveness necessarily but need to not see that person as an evil mortal enemy.
Sure. And I mean there actually is, you could say, a need for forgiveness. And we see it a lot of times but – in order for that to happen, a careful message had to be put out there. And what's lost in that message is, okay, what part of the narrative is then being shaped? What's being lost? And it's black participation within the war. If you look through these lost cause mantras, if you look through all of these readings, you don't have self-emancipation. You don't have 180,000 black troops who are fighting for their own freedom and doing so knowing that there will be no quarter given to them if they are captured. Instead, this has to be a white versus white conflict. This has to be a brother against brother war. And in order to make that stick, they had to cut out the black side. And so where we really see this and where I started with forgiveness on there is Gettysburg, 50th anniversary. You have this great – there had always been these blue-gray reunions where soldiers on both sides would meet. And it was about swapping battle stories because what better place to find unity than just soldier experience? Mm-hmm. Then it's not about the was I fighting for this ideology. It's that I was a person fighting in this. Let me tell you what my heroic actions were or that heroic action. So that's great unity. Well, at Gettysburg, at this 50th anniversary – you have the surviving veterans are given free passage. They can get free railway passage because at that point they're in their 70s mostly, mm-hmm. To the battlefield. They do a reenactment of Pickett's Charge where instead they meet at the center and they shake hands. And then the keynote is President Woodrow Wilson shows up and in front of this large gathering, he says that the Civil War is done. It's over. It's forgiven. It's past. But what's not seen in this, and this is one a lot of people who have seen the Ken Burns documentary films, they're a little bit dated now, but everyone still watches them, and mm-hmm. they can whistle that Ashokan farewell song. What this is shown in there, but what's not shown is that it's a segregated event. It's a Jim Crow event. Black veterans weren't invited to this event. Those who show up definitely uninvited and are writing things. They're horrified. Our Northern soldiers, have they forgotten that they won this war? Have they forgotten what this war was about? This whole idea of an emancipationist vision, war being over emancipation, over slavery, is pushed to the side in favor of reconciliation and moving forward as a country.
And of course, in that time frame, that's 50 years after the Civil War, so that's putting us around World War I, shortly after?
Lead up to, actually.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, this is 1913. So this is, it's an interesting time that you mentioned. Wilson, I don't think at this point, was definitely ready to get us into war, but we definitely did see the value of national unity. The Spanish-American War, we see this as a time period where the rhetoric of the Civil War becomes more about unity. There's even cartoons where you have a picture of a Union soldier with his arm around a Confederate soldier, and they're wrapped around the American flag and the word unity is beneath them, because we see this unity as useful. We need unity in time of war. Of all people, it was Frederick Douglass, who I think was 1875, who warned against this white unity that seems to be happening far too fast. And with it, the cause of the war, the radicalism of the war, the revolutionary nature of the war is being lost. But you do still have much of what I've talked about has been these various societies, a lot of them putting out various books, publications. There are black intellectual societies that are collecting and trying to put out black war experience, but they're not making their way into the modern consciousness in the same way.
Exactly. But then that makes me now wonder, what does get in front of everybody is the monuments. And when do these things start showing up?
Okay, so the monuments, first big push is 1880s, 1890s. This is when organizations have started gathering money. They're starting to put it together, and they're up. It's not coincidental that this is one of the big takeaways from historical memory is that so often it's so much more about politics of the day than it is actual memory of the event. So this is post-Reconstruction. This is after the South would say that it was redeemed from Northern invasion and carpetbagger rule. And these monuments are put up in that wake as segregation is becoming more and more firmly instilled state by state. Mm-hmm. As lynchings are going up and up and up, it's at the same point that we see these monuments becoming more often and more public. It wouldn't be incorrect to say that in a lot of ways that these are symbols of the South's racial order has been redeemed as well. Inherent with this lost cause ideology in all times is white supremacy, and these monuments are a representation of that.
When I'm hearing what you're talking about, I'm thinking of the modern iteration of the Daughters of the Confederate.
Yeah.
You know, so they're still around.
Oh, yeah.
And they would tell you, they're not racist. They're not white supremacists. That is not what they're about. They are just here about Southern tradition, Southern United States, don't tread on me, the whole deal. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So how would they square with what you're saying?
I have a feeling that I'm not going to be invited back to the United Daughters of the Confederacy anytime recently or anytime soon.
Have you been there?
I've talked in front of the United Daughters of the Confederacy once before, and what was interesting about that is they wanted to know specifically about the Native angle, because mm-hmm. that was what they had not heard before. I was expecting a lot more pushback than I got, but I really didn't get many. And one of them who invited me asked me to come back to her next historical society, which is for Daughters of Union Veterans as well. So she was actually on both sides of that.
I mean, do you think people that are involved right now maybe are interested in history, but they just don't know as much of it because they have gotten the sanitized version that was kind of handed down since, as you said, during the middle of the war?
Oh, yeah. No, this is a big part of it is this is what they learned. And they will always have facts that support their conclusions. Now, if you dig a little bit deeper, if you provide additional context, it makes them quite uncomfortable a lot of times. And part of, as a historian, one of the things that I have to do, I have to look at this is to an extent, if I'm when I'm talking with people who are in the UDC or have this opinion, it's talking through how did you come to this idea? Have you looked at this? What about this perspective? And more or less slowly moving them off of that position or asking them to reevaluate what got them there. But it's not comfortable. It never will be. It won't be to be told that this is what – because it is personal. It's rare that somebody is first-generation United Daughters of the Confederacy. It's somebody who my mother believed this, my grandmother believed this, my great-grandmother. And what are you saying about them if you're saying that what they believed wasn't true? So it has to be slowly just moving off of that to here's how they learned it. One of the ways that I do it with classes – because it is primarily what I'm doing is teaching, is I take the textbooks that were written by the United Daughters of the Confederacy that were pushed out, the 1890s, 19-teens, 1920s, and I say, can you please, with this textbook, make a history lesson that you would teach to a class? And immediately it becomes incredibly uncomfortable because it describes slavery as beneficial towards slaves and genial and benign. The war was not about slavery in any way at all. And then to their absolute shock, it's the praise of the KKK, that the Klan saved and redeemed the South through mostly nonviolent measures and are the true heroes of both the Civil War and Reconstruction. And once we get to the point where they've read through that and say, okay, well, I don't stand by this, I don't agree with this, well, then maybe it's, well, let's look at some of these other things. But no, I don't expect, or let me say this a different way. What happens today is that these conversations are not long conversations. Instead, they're tweet-length conversation, or if they're going to take place at one of these monuments, it's going to be a shouting match of one angry sentence versus one angry sentence. Though they might harden someone in their position, they're not changing minds. To change minds, to educate, to open up, it takes a little bit more of an investment than that. And I like to think that that's what I'm trying to do, and that's what I try to do.
So when things like this happen and, you know, somebody lashes out and topples a thing like we just saw down here in Fort Myers, things like that, I would imagine, don't surprise you.
No, they don't surprise me at all because of what those statues, those monuments, what they represent, and the fact that we haven't come to terms with them. We haven't reconciled with them. And so part of the questions, if you ask historians, do you think that monuments should be toppled? We definitely get a little bit a little shaky when talking about that. Most would say shouldn't be on public land and they should have more context. But I think more historians understand the fact that if they're just standing there as it is, and as a symbol to what they represent, that people are going to take actions like they have. In this case, seems carefully unscrewing the monument and lightly dropping. That's possibly the strangest thing to me.
Gingerly placed.
Exactly. It almost seemed like this is making a statement rather than wanting to full-on destroy.
Well, it's interesting also that you see, like, when I've gone down there, whenever there are people protesting things, a lot of the conversation is white people having a conversation with other white people.
Sure. Yeah, I've definitely seen that. But, I mean, I've seen other times where, I mean, NAACP has been there, and then it becomes, to an extent, less about the history than it does about the present. It becomes the history is history, you can't change it. And wanting to divorce themselves, the present, from the realities of history, or then it becomes a trivia match.
Well, then the issue is whether or not it's even an accurate representation of history.
Oh,
and glorification of a thing that wasn't real.
Sure. And that's it. It's not. And this is one of the first points I normally make because people love to throw around the term revisionist history. And these monuments are the revision. These are the rewrite. They are carefully crafted to deceive, to paint a picture of an idyllic past for certain people that never existed.
These are just hard things, though, for people to accept as part of the heritage of this country. It's just really hard to think that there was a time when a lot of people thought that slavery was a great idea.
Yeah.
It's and just hard to – I mean, it wasn't that long ago either.
No, it really wasn't. And I mean, there seems to be more and more of a push for people no longer want a warts and all history. They want a truly nationalistic, let's only talk about the great things of the nation rather than, what are the horrors of our history? And as historians, we're more looking and saying we can have both things. It's possible to teach Indian removal. It's possible to teach slavery. It's possible to teach lynchings and also teach incredible accomplishments of this nation.
Here we are in the county of Lee, named for said
yes.
Lee. Who is this person and how has his persona been altered and changed over the years?
It's called the Marble Man. He in a lot of ways was the perfect person to be downright deified. And I say deified, you can find Robert E. Lee in stained glass standing in the traditional Jesus pose, arms out, deified by the South.
Where's that?
That is in Virginia. There's a – oh, I
really?
I can show you the pictures. You have Stonewall Jackson with him at Chancellorsville and yeah.
So who was he?
Okay. So who was he? He obviously he's General Army of Northern Virginia, which many historians have argued really was the Confederacy as far as from a nationalist perspective. That army defined the nation. He was known for – I mean he was seen as an honorable person, always honest, always forthright, honorable in battle. This is the reputation that he gets. What's not covered or is carefully covered is that Robert E. Lee was a slaveholder. People would say, no, he inherited slaves from his father-in-law, but that still makes him a slaveholder. Before the war, it was it had been said that the Custis slaves would be freed, and there was a controversy on whether he was or not. So he writes about slavery, and in his personal correspondence, he talks about slavery. And what he says point blank is that openly that he is against slavery, but his reasons are that he doesn't like what it does for white people. When it looks at slaves themselves, he actually thinks it's good for black people to be enslaved. He has sayings when he says the harsh discipline they're receiving right now is beneficial to them as a race, that this will help build them up. And he was known for his brutality as a slave master. So this is who Robert E. Lee is. But what gets put forward is the honorable, relatively he's gracious in defeat, brilliant military mind. And after the war, he doesn't lead some guerrilla band. Instead, he just goes home and rides his horse traveler around, becomes a university president. And when, ironically enough, when he's asked about memorials and if they should go up at places like Gettysburg, he said, well, you know, maybe it's better to bury this past just a little bit. So of all people who might not want the Lee Memorial up, you could probably count Lee among them.
So we've had these monuments. They started going up, as you said, I think in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Yeah.
And then they kind of went away when we went into wartime situations. But then they kind of came back during the civil rights movements.
Absolutely. Right? Yes.
And then we didn't really hear a whole lot about them. I mean, they're there. But now all of a sudden we're hearing about them a lot in the last couple of years. Why do you think that is?
No, and it's an interesting question because we did not hear about them. When I was a student at University of North Texas, I can remember there's the square where all the restaurants are around and you park at the square. I don't know how many times I parked right underneath a Confederate monument and never knew it. Nobody ever pointed to it. Nobody ever thought of it. I think the true turning point was Dylann Roof and the way that after he executed 8 people in South Carolina, and people went back through and what motivated, what drove Dylann Roof. And there are a lot of things, and I don't want to oversimplify, but from his own writings, he's taking on some of this lost cause rhetoric. He talks about slavery as beneficial and for enslaved people and that they enjoyed their enslavement. And he's taking some of these sources that would be used by lost cause rhetoric. And I hate to put it in these kind of cynical terms, but after the Charleston shooting, we as a society could have made very difficult decisions and started looking at race in a much more profound way, started talking about structural inequality, started talking about racial stereotypes, or we could go after something that people were more open to looking at, which was, in fact, these monuments.
The symbolism.
Exactly. The symbolism, which then only picked up even more steam when Richard Spencer and his Unite the Right rally gathered in Virginia to defend, of all things, their Tiki Torch Army.
Yeah.
Defending Robert E. Lee and chanting, "You shall not replace us," among other things. So this became then part of the larger political polarization that we're facing right now.
So it was, instead of actually talking about race, talking
yes.
about like an honest accounting of what's going on and where is this racism and how do we deal with it and how do we move – instead of that, people wanted to deflect and just look at an inanimate object as the thing that makes these things happen.
An inanimate object and something that I think could make people feel a little bit more comfortable because they could say, well – looking at a Civil War memorial, if I'm okay with taking that down, that's more about the past than about my present. That way somebody doesn't have to approach what's actually happening in the present. It was more the easier way, the easier case to make.
Which, I mean, extrapolating that even further, it's kind of like it's a salve to make the white person feel a little bit better. Like, hey, look how evolved I am. I've done great. But it's still just a pittance to the black people in our country who – all they're getting is a symbol taken down. It doesn't really change the economic inequality, the issues and the opportunity, all the other things that kind of go with the system that we have in place and how different races are treated.
Exactly. It is an action. And what I myself and other historians have very much learned about or worried about is what happens if people see this as the panacea? Well, I took down the monument, so solved racism, check that one off, that one's done. Or take down the monument and now, okay, so we don't talk about Civil War perspective nearly as much. So this is where we get into firmer debates of – harder debates of what it is that we should be doing here. Should we be just – taking them straight down? Should they be moved to museums? Should commemorative plaques be put up? And I think that's the debate we're setting at instead of the debate of what are race relations like in the United States right now and how did we get there?
That was a conversation with Dr. Jeffrey Fortney, assistant FGCU professor of history, talking about the documented history of Civil War and what's happened since then. When we return, WGCU's Mike Canary sits down with Susie Hansen, an American journalist and author who has lived in Istanbul, Turkey, for the past 12 years. They'll discuss her upcoming lecture at FGCU called The Two Americas: Can Americans See America the Way the Rest of the World Does? I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.